And here we are live on the Renegade Economist with Professor Frank Stillwell.
Professor of Political Economy at the University of Sydney. Thanks for talking us today, Frank.
My pleasure.
Frank's the author of a book called Who Gets What? And today we want to ask a few questions about his analysis of the wealth gap in Australia and economic inequality. So can we start off, Frank? One of the arguments that's often run by free market economists and a number of other schools of thought is that capitalism generates inequality, and that's simply the way it is. Is this true, do you think?
Well, it's certainly the way it is. All capitalist societies have always been unequal. Mark you, there's no utopian, egalitarian society anywhere on the landscape. It's just that under capitalism, there are particular forces that tend to generate a polarisation between wealth and poverty. It's commonly said that capital breeds capital. After all, it's those who've got savings, those who've are employing others in a position to make profits, can use that to accumulate their wealth, whereas others are often spend their lifetime struggling just to make ends meet and never develop that surplus which would give them the capacity to become wealthy. That's always the case with capitalism, although, of course, equally true, some capitalist societies are more unequal than others.
And, Frank, Who Gets What is it's an encyclopedia of recent economic reports in Australia. I was impressed by how many different reports you've referenced here. What for yours was one of the most interesting reports you stumbled across during your research?
Well, Carl, simply the facts of the matter as reported by the official government statistician, the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It's not the most exciting source of information in Australia, but there's a wealth of data there showing the distribution of wage incomes, showing the distribution of incomes that come from other sources. And it's supplemented by the household income and labour dynamics study that shows the concentrations of wealth. In other words, shows who's got wealth in housing, who's got wealth in shares, who's got money in the bank. And you've also got other sources of information such as the Business Review Weekly, which produces annually its Rich 200 list, showing the wealthiest people in Australia, people like Kerry Packer, but of course now his son James Packer, who inherited Kerry's billions and seems to be modestly increasing the pile even further. So there's no shortage of reports, no shortage of information. We know who gets what, albeit, of course, we might have different judgments, different beliefs about whether or not those outcomes are tolerable or not.
So what would you call, or what do you see as the main features of the wealth gap in Australia and you know, their basic causes and the way that they're manifested in I guess, what most people would see as the economic machinations in society?
Yeah, well, I mean, historically, two things have kept inequality in check. One has been the role of trade unions, defending the interests of workers, making sure that exploitation doesn't reach extreme levels. And the other check has been governments providing a welfare state, other social security benefits to help the poor, and to some extent also doing the Robin Hood trick of taking money from the rich through progressive income taxes, and thereby levelling out the distribution of income to some extent. But both of those forces have been in retreat in recent times. Trade unions now only cover a quarter of the workforce. Governments have been introducing legislation like the Work Choices legislation that is designed to cut trade union power even more, and that therefore opens up the scope for higher rates of exploitation. And governments, now we find both Labor and Liberal governments, committed to reducing the tax on higher income earners in order to, so to speak, create incentives, but at the expense of creating a more unequal society. These are the forces that have been creating change, along with, of course, the other general forces of globalization that have increased the power of big business and neoliberalism that have reduced the capacity of governments to actually pursue a broader agenda about social justice and egalitarianism.
So stemming from that then, in your opinion, what's the most effective way to go about closing the wealth gap?
Well, one very significant initiative would be land taxation. A lot of the inequalities that we've seen in Australian society in recent times have stemmed from the ownership of land. People talk about it normally as a housing crisis, as housing gets more expensive, but it's really the land that has got more expensive. And those who've owned land have got vast increases in their wealth without any productive effort, just sitting and accruing the benefits of those inflationary tendencies in the value of their assets. A government that was committed to a more egalitarian society would, I think, begin with land taxation, particularly focusing on the role that land has played in creating these inequalities between those who get a lot of wealth from land and those who are facing chronic problems of housing affordability because they're outsiders, not insiders, in the land racket.
And Frank, in your studies there, what percentage of income are some of the upper echelons earning through what we call economic rent, speculative income, rather than their actual wage-based income?
I mean, it's commonly said, of course, you never get rich through work. I mean, you get rich through playing with other people's money. There's one character in the Business Review Weekly data, for example, whose wealth increased by an equivalent to $8 million a day over the last year. You don't get that in a wage packet. You don't even get it through being a corporate executive. You get it, in his case, by being a funds manager playing with other people's financial assets for your personal gain. But there are, of course, a broader strata of Australian society, executive officers in corporations who've been really coining it in. The head of Macquarie Bank last year got paid, or should I say paid himself, over $30 million, which is more than 100 Australians would get in the whole of their working lives. Mm. So these are examples, and they're not just isolated examples. If you look at the chief executive officers of the top 50 corporations in Australia, they're now getting on average 63 times average earnings of Australian workers. Mm. 15 years ago, they were getting 18 times as much as the average. Now they're rewarding themselves 63 times as much as the average, quite out of proportion to any increase in share values or the profitability of the companies they manage. In other words, we've developed within society a stratum of people who are able to cream off the wealth created in society for their own personal advantage in a way that's not wholly justified by reference to their productive contribution.
And it's underwritten by the signals the tax system orchestrated by the government is channeling to them. And, I mean, how can we relate these phenomenal wage differences between workers and CEOs back to the central reform plank you were talking of before, the highly controversial land tax, or as some people prefer to call it, a site rental?
A site rental, yeah. I mean, it's a big question that I think people will wildly disagree about. Some people, you know, think that the right to own your own home tax-free is somehow God-given to Australians. Others take the view that nature is indeed God-given and that we privatise it in ways that actually work against broader social interests, that work against ecological goals, and that we need to ensure that the surplus arising from the privatisation of land goes back as a sort of a social dividend to the community, or goes to finance things that would indeed address some of our ecological and social stresses, putting the revenues from those sites back into public housing, putting them into environmental programs, the restoration of degraded lands, and so on. There's no shortage of good things that we as a society need to invest in if we can set up the taxation arrangements that can generate the revenues for those purposes. So my punchline to the story is really all about political commitment. Where there's a will, there's a way. It seems, though, that the major parties, particularly now they're in election mode, aren't willing to really address the policies that would create a fairer and more stable society. Indeed, there's an ethical basis here. We need to grasp the argument for social justice, ecological sustainability, and make sure that our economic arrangements are in tune with those broader goals.
And Frank, just a last question from me. As a professor of economics, you would know well and truly how theoretically sound this capturing of economic rent through a site rental is. What are the whispers along the corridors of in the economics fraternity about the potential for site rental to be implemented, and how we can move this forward?
Well, if you hung around the corridors of economics departments in most Australian universities, you wouldn't hear much about this story at all. The economists, I think, as a profession, have ignored some of the insights coming from great thinkers such as Henry George. They've emphasized a much more narrow neoclassical theory that treats land, labor, and capital as if they were all similar factors of production. It's a theory that regards each of these factors of production being rewarded in accordance to their productivity. So it sets aside all the big questions about land, social inequality, and how we might create a fairer society. The economists have become the high priests of the vested interests in this process. But of course there are always dissidents, and I'm happy to be a dissident in this process. I'll draw on the ideas of all sorts of dissident economists: Henry George, Karl Marx, John Kenneth Galbraith, people who are engaged with trying to understand society, change it for the better, rather than just to serve the vested interests in the current economic order.
And on that note, Frank, just a final question from me as well. A lot of these characteristics are universal of a lot of economic systems around the world. You mentioned before that it seems some people sort of think that the right to own your own home and that sort of thing is God-given to Australians. And I think that a lot of people would equate that with the sort of Australian dream. So what kind of, are there any defining characteristics of the Australian situation that you would point to as possibly shaping our economic future in one direction or the other?
Yes, thinking from first principles, of course we've got a marvellous continent here. I mean, a huge land, much of it not suitable for economic production, but relatively small population relative to land, population that's largely concentrated in half a dozen major cities. We have the capacity to be world leaders in the way in which we manage our land, balance those goals of social justice, ecological sustainability. I think we're missing the boat, have been for some time. I mean, the land grab and the attempt to use land as a vehicle for personal gain rather than simply as the backdrop to our economic and social lives is of long standing. But all is not lost. If we had governments committed to creating fairer outcomes, and increasingly, I think, with the focus on the concerns about ecological sustainability. We'll develop new policies for land. We'll develop policies indeed that make housing more affordable, indeed make that great Australian dream more possible for Australians who are currently frustrated by the nightmare that they face in land and housing markets if they're outsiders rather than insiders. So though I think there's lots of features of Australian economic social policy that we've got wrong, I remain very optimistic that once these issues are more generally understood and once we've got more committed political leadership, then indeed we could take up that opportunity to become world leaders in showing the way forward.
Excellent, Frank. Well, great to have you on the show, and we'll look forward to chatting to you in the future.
Thank you. My very pleasure. Much, Frank.
So thanks for the invitation to talk with your listeners.